It was one of London's worst disasters in decades.
Human life was never a priority, and we lost friends, neighbours and loved ones in the most horrific way.
The damning conclusions of an official inquiry into the 2017 Grenfell Tower fire. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also, Pope Francis is in Indonesia, part of a four-nation tour for the 87-year-old head of the Catholic Church.
This is his seventh visit to Asia, so he is making this continent a priority.
And in rural Japan, an old school gets shuttered but becomes a community center on the weekends.
This local says we get to meet people of all ages who we'd never otherwise meet.
All those stories and more coming up today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for tuning in today. Incompetence, dishonesty, and greed. That's what led to the deaths of 72 people in the Grenfell Tower fire in London. The conclusions of a long-awaited report on that 2017 disaster came out today. And the bottom line in the government inquiry is that the fire never should have happened.
The blame here is shared by several manufacturing firms, successive British governments, and the London Fire Brigade for their respective roles in the high-rise fire in the North Kensington neighborhood. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry joined us earlier today, and I asked her about these findings, which are highly critical of the British government.
Yeah, it talks about a path to disaster at Grenfell, which stretches right back to the early 1990s, from the Conservative governments to the Labour governments to coalition governments. It said they ignored, they delayed, they disregarded concerns about fire safety in high-rise buildings and how that's managed and regulated. But the report also made the point that in 2010, under David Cameron's Conservative government, there was this big push towards loosening red tape to boost economic growth. So now we have a new Labour government in office, and you had victims' families gathered in the House this afternoon to have a listen to what the Prime Minister, the new Labour Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, had to say about it.
So, Mr. Speaker, I want to start with an apology on behalf of the British state to each and every one of you, and indeed to all of the families affected by this tragedy. It should never have happened.
Now, you mentioned that some of the families of the victims were in Parliament today. What can you tell us about their responses to the inquiry and its findings?
It's a sort of a bittersweet day for them. I mean, on the one hand, you finally have this report 7 years after the disaster. It lays out very clearly the systematic failures by governments, by manufacturing companies, by the local authority, by the fire brigade. But on the other hand, no one has been brought to justice for any of this. The chair of the inquiry, Martin Moore-Bick, he was very careful this morning also to talk about the victims. And at one point, he paused and he read out the full list of names of those who died in the blaze.
Hashim Kadir, Noura Jamal, Yahya Hashim, Firdaus Hashim.
And as you might hear from some of the names there, many of them were not born in Britain. Many were immigrants. There were asylum seekers and refugees. The first victim that was named after the blaze broke out that night was a man who had fled the Assad regime in Syria. And they ranged in age from, it came out in the report today, actually, there was an unborn baby up to a six-month-old and right up to an 84-year-old. And they were living also, of course, alongside some very poor British families, but in the wealthiest borough in London, in Kensington and Chelsea. So it's, you know, Grenfell is very much a symbol of social inequality in the UK. But Natasha Elcock, who survived the fire, her uncle was killed in the blaze. She was speaking outside the inquiry this morning, and she was saying what's most difficult for her to hear is that the judge said every single loss of life that night was avoidable.
Human life was never a priority, and we lost friends, neighbours and loved ones in the most horrific way through greed, corruption, incompetence and negligence.
Orla, what about the private companies involved? They are accused of greed. I mean, no mincing words there. Have any of these firms issued public statements in response?
They have. And actually, the harshest criticism in the report was made against an American firm, Arconic. Its French subsidiary made these cladding panels, these combustible cladding panels that were installed on the outside of the Grenfell Tower. And the report said today that that company, Arconic, deliberately concealed from the market the true extent of the danger danger of using the materials that were added to Grenfell. Arconic came out this afternoon with a statement. They said they rejected any claim that its subsidiary sold an unsafe product. It said it regularly conducts tests of its material and that it's cooperating fully with the inquiry.
Orla, what happens now? No one's been criminally charged in connection to the Grenfell fire, right?
Right. The Met Police began a criminal investigation back in 2017 when the fire happened. But then they said they wanted to see what the findings of the official inquiry would be. Today, they said it'll likely be close to 2027 before prosecutions are brought. They said because of the sheer volume of evidence and complexity of the investigation. It's frustrating for the families. One campaigner was saying this morning at a press conference, his mother died in the blaze. And he said he was going from hospital to hospital trying to find his mother when the inquiry was announced. And here we are, he said, 7 years on and no one has been charged. And that's really a huge source of anger and pain for many of the survivors and the victims' families today.
Yeah, no doubt. Orla Barry is the world's Europe correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Part of the reason the Olympics and Paralympics are so special is because they only happen every 4 years. Oksana Masters, though, only has to wait 2 years between games because she competes in both the Winter and Summer Paralympics. The world's Bianca Hillier has the story of a multi-sport athlete representing two seasons and two countries.
Oksana Masters is a rower, a Nordic skier.
There goes Oksana Masters. She has left Lee Pon-Pon behind.
And a biathlete, a winter sport that combines cross-country skiing and rifle shooting.
And it is a clean day for Oksana Masters, 10 for 10 on the range.
This week in Paris, she's competing for Team USA in yet another event as she seeks to defend her titles from Tokyo in cycling.
She wins the elusive double.
Masters has earned 18 Paralympic medals throughout her career, including one gold medal just this morning. And competition undoubtedly fuels her. But her source of motivation changed when Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022.
It's no longer just about me chasing a gold medal. I'm on the start line representing Ukraine.
Masters was born in Ukraine in 1989, just 3 years after the Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster. In utero, radiation is believed to have damaged her legs, hands, and some of her organs, and she was given up for adoption because of her need for extensive medical care. Masters spent 7 years in orphanages before an American woman adopted her, but she's always remembered her roots.
I am so proud to be Ukrainian.
Oksana Masters has another gold medal.
When Masters made the podium at the Beijing Paralympics, which took place just days before Russia's full-scale invasion, she donated her prize money to Ukrainian children in need. That opportunity is what fuels her now in Paris.
I will be donating my proceeds and my winnings to an organization just like I did in Beijing. And that, for me, is how I make it mean something more than just lining up.
Masters says the past 2 years have made her want to reconnect with her birth family in Ukraine, some of whom have been killed in the war.
Still trying to find a way to talk about it and not cry, because my dream is to meet my birth family, whoever I can. I want to meet them and say thank you, because now as an adult, I know they didn't have the resources to give me what I needed.
She says she's come to peace with her past with the help of a sports psychologist and the Ukrainian sports community.
I'm so lucky because I have Team USA, but I have Team Ukraine supporting me. And I'm getting, like, the Ukrainian Paralympic Committee is constantly supporting and liking, commenting, sending me messages.
Masters will be channeling that support even while wearing red, white, and blue in Paris. She competes in the women's cycling road race tomorrow morning. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Since it gained independence back in 1917, Finland has lived right next to a much larger and more powerful neighbor, Russia. The two countries share a border more than 800 miles long, and cross-border relations have become pretty thorny. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022 pushed Finland to join NATO, and late last year, Finland closed its land border with Russia. Now, the Finnish government is going a step further, banning property sales to most Russians. repercussions. Katarzyna Zisk is paying close attention to these developments. She's a professor at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council.
Russia has for years shown an interest in purchases of properties close to strategic locations, close to, for instance, military bases, close to critical infrastructure. And the problem is that such buildings can be used potentially for hostile activities, such as, you know, they can act as bases for surveillance and intelligence gathering activities. They can also be used for sabotage. One can control drones from such locations. And this we have seen in Finland, but also in Sweden and in Norway as well.
You mentioned these properties are near strategic locations like military bases, but what kinds of properties exactly are these that Russians have bought in Finland in recent years?
In Finland, we know that there were some locations, again, close to critical infrastructure. Some of them were fortified with helipads. We know that in Norway, for instance, the Russian Orthodox Church purchased properties that were in very close location to the most important base in Norway, which is the Haakonsvern. And they had full view of what is, you know, going in and out of the base. You know, I mean, this is at least suspicious.
So the Finnish government is proposing that most Russians would be banned from buying property there. What does that most Russians mean? Who could still buy property?
This is really hard to say. We do not know the details in the law, but I guess the Finnish authorities will be extremely keen on screening the persons interested in purchases of properties in Finland against their connections to the Russian government, to the Russian intelligence agencies, to the Russian maybe businesses, which we know often are very closely connected to the Russian government.
Is there any concern that some of these suspicions about properties owned by Russians are based more on rumors or, you know, stereotypes than hard evidence?
Well, there is enough hard evidence to be suspicious, I would say it like that. But certainly we cannot accuse all Russians of having hostile intentions. The problem is that even the Russian government has been claiming for years that it has been in a kind of quiet war with the West, again, using non-military ways and means. We had, for instance, in Montenegro in 2016, in Moldova probably last year, enormous amount of cyber attacks. So there is this broad spectrum that we unfortunately have to see as a coordinated campaign. And given the Western support for the war in Ukraine, these kind of ways and means are getting even more important in hands of the Russian government because of the weakness of the Russian conventional forces, because Russia's use of non-nuclear weapons and nuclear threats has been weakened. So this is something that Russia actually can use to try to, you know, infuse fear, perhaps infuse some chaos, threaten and try to convince the Western societies and the leadership to change their policies towards Ukraine, because I think that's the major objective behind these kind of activities.
So Finland gained its independence from the Russian Empire a little over 100 years ago. Can you compare, you know, where that relationship is today and how high tensions are compared to, you know, previous tough points in the two countries' history?
Yes, I mean, the relations between Russia and Finland have deteriorated significantly since the Russian reinvasion of Ukraine. And the reinvasion has changed the Finnish perception of Russia radically, which led Finland to join NATO. And since that event, Russia has been trying to weaponize migration by encouraging asylum seekers from the Middle East and African countries to cross the Russian border into Finland. We know that there has been some Russian violation of Finnish territorial waters and Russian planes have violated Finnish airspace. So there is this tension and this sort of Russian poking of Finland. So I think Finland is trying to take certain measures to protect itself, including, you know, blocking all migration between Finland and Russia, and now also trying to patch the gaps when it comes to buying, for instance, properties in strategic locations.
Katarzyna Zisk is a professor at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. This next story is about a girl, Rosanna Salcedo, now a woman, who grew up in New York City. She spoke Spanish at home with her Dominican family.
But she formed a special bond with an older woman who taught her English. Rosanna Salcedo shared her story about how her friendship with that woman grew on GBH's Stories from the Stage.
Both of my parents emigrated from the Dominican Republic to New York City in the 1960s after the Trujillo dictatorship. when they were in their teens. They came independently of each other, neither of them having received much formal education. My mother became a factory worker in a sweatshop on Delancey Street. My father was a physical laborer. Eventually, they met and married, and they had this sweet girl 2 years later. When I was 3 and my father was 25, my family got its first big break. My father knew someone who knew someone who knew a landlord who needed a superintendent for his building on 187th Street and Cabrini Boulevard in Washington Heights, New York City. My father went to talk to the landlord. The landlord explained that the superintendent would be responsible for making sure that the building always had heat and hot water, for fixing things when they were broken, for removing trash from the building several times a week, and keeping the building clean. In return, the super and his family would be allowed to live in a windowless two-bedroom apartment in the basement, rent-free, and would receive a modest salary. My father was thrilled. He eagerly accepted the position. This would allow us to live in a more affluent neighborhood than we could afford. It would allow me and my brothers to attend a better public school, and it would allow my mother to be a stay-at-home mom. To subsidize my father's salary, my mother would often clean apartments in the building after he came home from work. One of the women for whom she cleaned was Edith Mesabov. She was an elderly Jewish woman who lived directly above us on the first floor, and she got to know us really well. The windows to Edith's apartment overlooked the front of the building. And in good weather, when my brothers and I played on the sidewalk, Edith would sit by her kitchen window and watch us playing for hours. Eventually, she would reach out, wave, and call out, "Hi, Rosie, hi, Angel." And we would stop what we were doing and smile and wave back, but we couldn't really communicate because we didn't speak much English. Edith told my mother that she would be willing to meet with me on a regular basis to help improve my English language skills in preparation for school. My mother gratefully accepted the offer. I began to meet with Edith twice a week in her kitchen. At first, the meetings were awkward. Edith was so much older than me, and everything about Edith was different. I was most struck by how utterly alone she lived. In contrast, I lived with my parents and my siblings. My abuela lived 2 or 3 blocks away, and I saw her every weekend. And my tios and primos and tias also lived in the neighborhood. My house was always full of people. But I thought, Edith must be somebody's abuela. And she's sweet and kind and gentle and always has cookies for me when we have our sessions. By the time kindergarten came around, I was ready. I was confident. One holiday, Edith asked my mother if she could take me to the theater, and my mother said yes. I was so excited. That Saturday, I put on my best Sunday clothes, my white tights and patent leather shoes, and when Edith came to get me, I saw that she was also wearing her fancy clothes, and she took me by the hand, and we walked down to the bus stop on Fort Washington Avenue to wait for the number 4 bus. The number 4 bus travels from the northern tip of Manhattan all the way down to Midtown. When the bus came, we boarded the bus and I was able to get a window seat. And from there, I could see the neighborhood's transition from Washington Heights to Harlem. And then on 110th Street, the bus turns and curls around the east side of Central Park, continuing its trajectory down Fifth Avenue. By that point, I felt like I was in a different world. I was most impressed by the structures, buildings like the Guggenheim and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. This was a part of New York I had not yet seen. At some point during the bus ride, Edith asked, "Rosie, are you hungry?" And I nodded yes. She said, "Do you want a bagel?" And I said, "What's a bagel?" And everyone erupted in laughter. We got off on 54th Street and walked a couple of blocks to the Ziegfeld Theater. The Ziegfeld is an old New York theater, all red velvet and shiny brass. It was definitely the fanciest place I have ever been. Edith bought exotic snacks for me called Raisinets. And we took our seats. As it turns out, we were going to watch a viewing of Disney's Fantasia. You can imagine my childhood delight when I saw Mickey as big as life on the giant screen. This was also my introduction to classical music. It was one of the most memorable moments of my life. As I got older and I progressed in school and I made new friends, my friendship with Edith became less and less important. We didn't have our regular sessions anymore. It wasn't necessary. I was actually excelling in school. One day, when I came home from school, I was in junior high school at the time. I came home and my mother was really, really upset. She told me that Edith had passed away. My parents hadn't seen or heard her for a while, and when they went to check on her, they found her. As it turns out, Edith did have a daughter on the West Coast, and my father knew how to contact her. When Edith's daughter came to take care of her mother's remains, my family and I went to pay our respects. We went up to the apartment and knocked on the door. When she opened the door, she looked at me and said, "You must be Rosie. I know all about you." She welcomed us inside and we sat with her for a while. At some point, she asked me to accompany her to Edith's bedroom, and she led me to Edith's dresser. On top of Edith's dresser was a number of framed pictures of me at different stages in my life. Me on a tricycle, my first grade class picture with my front teeth missing, me during my first Holy Communion. I always understood the impact that Edith had had on my life. But until that moment, I had never really thought about the impact that I may have had on hers. Thank you.
Rosana Salcedo from GBH's Stories from the Stage. To hear more, go to theworldchannel.org.
Coming up next, we head to Southeast Asia, where the Pope is making a 12-day visit. It's the longest and farthest tour in his papacy. You're listening to The World.
He was once part of the political elite in Lebanon with a reputation for being above the law. But the former head of the central bank was just detained by authorities and might do time in prison.
He has everybody's secrets. It's a joke running in Beirut that the Excel sheets and the USB that Mr. Salemi has are what kept him alive so far.
That's still ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Pope Francis is on another big international trip this week. He's in Jakarta, Indonesia at the moment and is getting a warm welcome. The head of the Catholic Church will visit three other countries on his 12-day trip to the Asia Pacific. Elise Allen is a senior correspondent for the Catholic news site Crux and is traveling with the Pope.
You know, Pope Francis really drove home, I think, the core message of what he wants to convey in Indonesia this morning when he met with civil authorities. He really put forward a message of tolerance. He invoked Indonesia's diversity, cultural and ethnic diversity. I mean, there are over 1,000, I think over 1,300 different ethnicities present in Indonesia. So he said this is something Indonesia really must treasure and preserve. He really reinforced the need to fight extremism and to embrace this almost vocation of tolerance that Indonesia has. And he brought that home again when he met with clergy and religious leaders this afternoon in the cathedral here in Jakarta. He asked the church's pastors here basically to be open-minded and inclusive and to be embracing of everyone. So that's really been his core message.
You mentioned civil society leaders, religious leaders that Pope Francis has met with so far. Who else is he meeting with on this trip to Indonesia?
So tomorrow morning, he's actually going to meet with interreligious leaders at Jakarta's main mosque, the Istiqlal Mosque, which sits directly across the street from the Catholic Cathedral and is connected to the cathedral via an underground tunnel called the Tunnel of Fraternity. So this is going to be a very symbolic event for Pope Francis and a chance for him to really engage the other religious leaders present. He's also going to have a meeting with poor and needy beneficiaries of charitable organizations, and he's going to celebrate Mass tomorrow afternoon for Indonesia's Catholic population. Catholics here are only about 3.1% of the overall population, but they still number around 8 million people. So that is a huge huge part of the Pope's own flock. And it's a big part of his engagement with the local church here as well. And there's a lot of excitement building ahead of that encounter.
What message do you think Pope Francis is hoping to send to the wider world, especially Catholics around the world, by visiting Southeast Asia and engaging with that small Catholic minority in Indonesia?
So the Pope has a huge affinity for Asia. This is his seventh visit to Asia. So he is making this continent a priority. And I think he's doing that not only because of the growth rate of Catholicism in Asia. Asia has one of the fastest growing populations globally. And with that, one of the fastest growing Catholic populations, because the growth of the church follows more or less the growth of the overall population. So Asia is increasingly a power player on the global scene. And so it's really a nod to not just the future of the Catholic Church, but also its present.
Elise, after Indonesia, the Pope will head to Papua New Guinea, East Timor, and Singapore. What are some of the highlights of the Pope's agenda on those stops?
You know, whenever the Pope travels somewhere, he has a geopolitical agenda, and that usually involves calling for peace, calling for tolerance, calling for reconciliation. That message, I think the message of peace and reconciliation will particularly resound in East Timor, given its recent independence. It's only been independent, you know, for a couple decades, like 20, 25 years. So it's that message, I think, will come out very strongly there. I think in Papua New Guinea, it'll be a strong message of inclusion and quality, where you're looking at a very poor country where a lot of inequalities exist.
Have the pace of these big papal visits changed at all as the Pope has aged?
Yes, it has. You know, at the beginning, he had packed schedules from, you know, morning to afternoon. There were events all day long. He was going, would add things, would speak off the cuff. And now we see a Pope who's more reserved, who has fewer events. There are large gaps in the middle of the day, allowing him to rest when he needs to. And he sticks to his speeches more. And he's still energetic. And just this afternoon, he was very energetic, you know, in his meeting with local clergy and religious leaders. He was sort of his old self, you know, that comes out sometimes still.
You've been reporting on the Vatican for years. Has anything surprised you about what Pope Francis has been saying in his speeches or to the people he's been meeting?
No, this is very much Pope Francis's classic agenda, you know, one of tolerance and inclusion, calls for peace, you know, wanting authorities and society in general to address social problems like poverty and injustice. We expect that he'll talk about climate change in this visit as well. So this is Pope Francis reiterating the things that have been important to him all along. And this trip itself and the places that he's visiting are really indicative of those priorities.
As you mentioned, climate change is an important issue for the Pope. What do you expect him to say about that topic, especially in a region that is being hit hard by the impacts of climate change?
Well, he's going to make a call for more responsible lifestyles. I think we can certainly expect that from him. He will talk about sort of the impacts of climate change in each of the places that he's going to be. He's going to talk about the impact on local populations, you know, the people themselves who suffer because of the effects of climate change. And what that means, not only for those people, but for the countries they live in, and how that can affect the broader global scene. So I think we can expect him to break that down a little bit, but also to issue a call to be more responsible with the way that we live and to think about the bigger picture, you know, and not just our own comforts or our own, you know, little world, but to think about, as he would say, the poor and those who are most vulnerable and most impacted.
Elise Allen is a senior correspondent for the Catholic news site Crux. She's traveling with the Pope through Southeast Asia.
In Japan, declining birth rates and the flight of young people to cities means that schools are shuttering in many rural areas where there simply aren't enough kids anymore to run a school. There are exceptions, though. In Ishikawa Prefecture near the Japan Sea, reporter Hannah Kirshner visited a former school that's become a new kind of community hub.
The village of Takigahara is in a valley along a river. This kind of landscape is called Satoyama, an ecosystem of forests and fields stewarded by people who live in the village. It's iconic Japanese countryside, bright green rice fields against a backdrop of dark green mountains and blue sky. The schools here closed over a decade ago. There just weren't enough children to keep them open. But a little before noon on a summer Saturday, the nursery school cafeteria fills up with about 30 people who live nearby. They're here for an event called Satoyama Shokudo, Satoyama Cafeteria. Twice a month, anyone can come eat lunch made with local ingredients for 1,000 yen, less than $10. And it's a lot of food. We're able to meet people of all ages who we wouldn't ordinarily meet. And it's a place we can eat really homey, warm food, says Shoko Ogawa. She's 38 and raising her daughter a few towns over, where there's still a school. Only one child actually lives here in Takigahara. 11-year-old Kanta Hoshi. His mom, Kotomi, went to this school when she was little. Even though it might be more convenient to move to a bigger town, she wanted her son to grow up here. While he's young, I want my son to experience things like living close to nature and playing in the river, she says. You can't get that kind of experience in the city.
My name is Yutaka Yamashita.
Yamashita Yutaka is 77. Back when this school closed in 2011, he was the town council chairman. I thought that the disappearance of the school would be the same as losing our community hub. So I thought of a way to make use of the space, says Yamashita. He started a program for all ages called Nature School. It includes activities like firefly viewing and picking wild leaves for herbal tea. Yamashita wants people to come here to learn about the Satoyama ecosystem and way of life instead of just looking things up online. The most important thing is to experience things with your eyes, mouth, nose, ears, touch, and to talk to each other, says Yamashita. Today's event, Satoyama Shokudo, is part of that. Yamashita's wife, Nobuko, is in charge of the kitchen, where she's dishing out food with three other grandmas. I think I'll do my best to keep going until I'm 90, about another 15 years, says Nobuko Yamashita. Today's lunch includes steamed white rice, sweet and sour pork, cold somen noodles topped with okra, potato salad with cucumbers and cherry tomatoes, and there's simmered kabocha, Japanese pumpkin, that's just coming into season. Chisan Chisho, locally grown, locally consumed, Nobuko Yamashita says. That's what we think about first when we make the menu. Although this village of about 150 people is mostly elderly, there are a handful of young people who moved here to farm and live close to nature.
I'm Ako. I'm 32 years old.
Ako Ihara keeps chickens in Takigahara and sells their eggs.
I have 24 chickens now.
Ihara says community is what brings her to Satoyama Shokudo. Vegetables these grandmas and grandpas grew, food the grandmas cooked, we get to eat these together with gratitude, she says, for the purpose of continuing this community. It seems unlikely that Japan's trend of rural depopulation will reverse. But places like Takigahara are finding ways to maintain a sense of community and cultural identity. For the world, I'm Hannah Kirshner, Takigahara, Japan.
It is hard to believe there is anything new left to say about the Titanic. The supposedly unsinkable ship went down in 1912, inspiring several films, including the best known with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. The shipwreck itself also still very much in the popular imagination.
More than a century later, the wreckage site and what we know about it continue to change. Recently, the first expedition to the site in years located a bronze statue that was on board the Titanic. Experts thought the object had been lost for good. But when RMS Titanic Inc. released images from the expedition on Monday, there she was, Diana of Versailles.
Diana is the Roman goddess, also known as Artemis, goddess of the hunt. This 2-foot-tall bronze has her gesturing in the midst of a purposeful stride, one arm raised. Only part of the statue is visible, though. About half of it is buried in sandy debris from the wreckage.
Another finding, part of the railing that surrounds a raised deck on the bow of the Titanic has now fallen. In a statement, RMS Titanic called the expedition a bittersweet mix of preservation and loss. This recent expedition to the shipwreck comes almost 1 year after the Titan submersible disaster in which 5 people in the mini-sub died.
On a remote Spanish archipelago, an ancient system of communication has survived for centuries and carries on even into our current internet age. Call it instant messaging across ravines and ridges. It's known as Silbo Canario, or canary whistling, found on Spain's Canary Islands in the Atlantic Ocean. The World's Jerry Haddon first reported this story from the island of La Gomera last fall.
This last Halloween, the streets of La Gomera's main town, San Sebastian, were packed with kids trick-or-treating. But 12-year-old Adonai Niebla stood quietly apart. He wasn't interested in candy. Instead, he and his dad, Oscar, had set up a challenge, kind of like a scavenger hunt.
We've hidden my wallet on a bench and my telephone in Oscar's pocket, and his son, who has not been watching, is now going to figure out where all these things are.
That's Oscar, Adonai's dad, whistling clues.
Just called his son. He's walking over now. And without hesitation, he's found my wallet and put it in my hand.
A few more whistled directions, and Adonai's also found my phone and returned it. All this without a word exchanged between father and son.
Lo que me gusta es como que es como una cosa que se hacía en el pasado.
What I like about the silbo, says Adonai, is that it's something from long ago, but it's still passed on from generation to generation. It's just like speaking, his dad says. There are people who talk really quickly, and you can't understand them. Slower is better, he says, especially if you need to whistle across a long distance. This is a message reaching me from a distance of about a mile on a windy ridge high above San Sebastian. The whistler, 28-year-old Silbo teacher Fran Niebla, no relation to Oscar, is telling me he's hungry and we should go eat. But his real aim here is just to show me how well the whistling works.
Exacto, se desarrolló porque si tú estás en esta montaña y otra persona en la otra montaña, ¿cómo vas y le dices que necesitas? Gritando no va a llegar.
The silbo developed, he tells me after, because if you're standing on this mountain and you need someone who's over there on that mountain, you'd never reach him by screaming. Only the shrill whistle can cut through the winds and cross the canyons of this rugged island, he says, and it's simple to learn.
Que lo que se basa es pasar de la palabra hablada a la palabra silbada. El silbo se basa básicamente.
The whole thing is based on turning the spoken word directly into a whistled word, he says. That's it. It's a communication system. For generations, this was La Gomera's broadband. You could whistle across a valley for help to, say, carry your bananas to market or to announce a death. You could warn a fire, pirates, or police entering the harbor, which would go like this.
Okay, Jorge, the police are coming to arrest you.
Little wonder Niebla says that the police, who didn't understand the whistles, would usually leave empty-handed. But today there's little practical use for the silbo, what with cell phone and internet coverage just about everywhere. But islanders are committed to keeping it alive. There are mandatory classes for kids in elementary schools and courses for adults. This is a one-on-one class that Niebla's giving at a small storefront in San Sebastian. He's helping local tour guide Rebecca Pellice with comprehension. First, the vowels. Pellice wants to impress her tourist clients with some new language skills, she says, just as she was impressed the first time she heard the silbo.
Oh, it was amazing. I was up there in a hill, and someone was whistling. I was like, wow, I want to learn that sound and how to whistle as well.
But learning how to whistle silbo style is hard. You can use 2 fingers, 1, or none at all. Here's Pellice, after months of classes, giving it her best.
I can try it, but yeah. It's going to be awful.
No, go for it.
So, yeah.
Pellecé struggles, but Fran Niebla says kids pick it up much faster. Back up on the ridge, he says that's a good thing. If the island were ever to suffer a prolonged, massive blackout, he says, we'll need whistlers. We would suddenly be kings, he says, because they'd be masters, once again, of the only means of long-distance communication, whistling the day's news and necessities, just like their ancestors. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, La Gomera, the Canary Islands, Spain.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. He served as the governor of Lebanon's central bank for 30 years. In 2023, he stepped down after being implicated in embezzlement and money laundering schemes. Now, Riyad Salameh has been arrested in Lebanon. Aliyah Ibrahim is the co-founder of the online Lebanese news outlet Daraj. She's based in Beirut.
He's been arrested for using his power at the central bank to make high commissions that were distributed among different people, amounting to around $8 billion of central bank money. These are the charges that he's facing in Lebanon. This is the first time in the period of since the end of the civil war that a person of this caliber is actually being prosecuted in Lebanon. To see Riyad Salameh yesterday in this image arrested is really an unprecedented event in Lebanon.
What price would you say average Lebanese have paid for these alleged crimes of Salameh?
I would tell you that there is over 1 million Lebanese depositors who have lost all their money locked in the banks. In October 2019, the central bank in Lebanon, at the time Mr. Salameh was still central bank governor, imposed an illegal and unofficial capital control. Overnight, even millionaires in Lebanon, I'm not going to tell you just the middle class, no one had access to all the money that they had locked in the banks. You're talking about the savings of people who worked all their lives. You're talking about salaries. You're talking about everything. They've lost it all. Lebanon overnight in 2019 moved from being a largely middle class country to being a poor country. Over 85% of the Lebanese population went overnight on the poverty line.
Aliyah, this scheme that Salameh is allegedly involved in, was it something that people in Lebanon knew about already or suspected?
The thing is, for 4 years almost now, there has been a lot of scandals. The particular case he was arrested for was neither the bigger or the very surprising one. And it was uncovered because of an auditing process that was conducted by Kroll, which is an international audit. And we wouldn't have known about that. I mean, if you look only at how the mainstream media in Lebanon, which is largely controlled by the banks and by the central bank and by Mr. Salameh himself, who, by the way, until very recently was being portrayed all over the Lebanese mainstream media as somebody who's being compromised for political reasons and for political assassination. That's how the mainstream media portrays it.
You're kind of leaning into perhaps an answer to my next question, because European prosecutors, as you pointed out, they say they've had evidence of Salameh's involvement in illegal financial activities for some time. What took authorities in Lebanon so long to catch up with him?
He was corrupt not only for himself. He made himself very rich, but he made also a lot of the Lebanese political parties. And he was, there was something, he was called the magician of Lebanon. That's how he was referred to, because he was the least controversial. It was, Lebanon had a civil war. Lebanon had militias that hated each other, that eventually became the political parties, very contradictory in their political ideologies and everything. The only thing and person everybody agreed on was the person of Mr. Riyad Salameh, who was also, by the way, all the time above suspicion. When we started investigating him 4 years ago, it did not even occur to us what we would find out.
I mean, are you suggesting that's because he was a banker who was really connected to the political elite?
He is the banker of the political elite. He has everybody's secrets. It's a joke running in Beirut that the Excel sheets and the USB that Mr. Salameh has are what kept him alive so far. So basically, this is really the guy who can bring everybody down.
And what would you say, Aliyah, are the clearest links between Salameh's alleged crimes and the broader financial crisis that Lebanon has been dealing with, is still dealing with in recent years?
I don't think it's fair or right to say that Salameh alone is responsible for the financial crisis. He played a definitely a central role because he was a regulator. If you look at the Optimum case today.
Let's say the brokerage company that Salem is accused of embezzling $110 million from.
The company itself should have been regulated by him as a central bank governor. So when you have the regulator itself also changed the law when he was in that position and became the auditing committee that basically looks at itself. So he was not held accountable for a day. And you're talking here about the whole establishment. And in that sense, I mean that you cannot blame him alone. For example, he broke the money and credit law by loaning money to the government, which is a no-go in the book. It's very clear by the money and credit law that you cannot give money to the government. Mm. And the position of the central bank governor in Lebanon is a stronger position than the president.
Aliya Ibrahim is a co-founder of the online news outlet Daraj. She joined us from Beirut.
More news from the UK now. Britain is set to become the first G7 industrialized nation to stop burning coal. Its last coal-fired power plant has already received its final shipment of the fuel.
The climate benefits may be obvious today, but the decline of coal for other reasons really began decades ago.
I want to see no more pit closures. No more job losses.
Mr. Chairman, what we have seen in the past few weeks is not picketing at all.
Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher stonewalled striking coal miners by 1984. A year-long coal miner strike shut down power stations, but Britain got by thanks to a discovery a decade earlier in the North Sea.
Sea Gem stands on the seabed 40-odd miles off the Humber coast. The scientists and engineers aboard the rig have found natural gas. And taking a longish view, this could be the largest bonus for Britain since the big-scale development of coal.
Britain could manage without coal. Baroness Bryony Worthington, a member of the House of Lords, remembers.
The biggest switch, the biggest saving that we made was from coal to gas. That was when the transition started, but now increasingly we've been replacing the coal with cleaner power from renewables.
Worthington started campaigning to end coal power in the early 2000s. Back then, coal still generated much of the UK's electricity.
Last year, it was down to 1%. The rest comes from renewables, wind, solar, and biomass, followed by natural gas and nuclear.
It's been a 20-year campaign, and it's good to see it finally ending.
When Britain's last power station shuts down later this month, the transition should not cause a single light bulb to flicker.
The UK was the first industrialized nation to make use of coal at scale, and we've got off it. Now we've got to help others to do the same.
That includes the US, which still burns coal to generate about 16% of its electricity.
In this scene from the film Brassed Off, it's 1984 again. We see a room full of British coal miners, part of the Mines Brass Band, in rehearsal, while scenes of violent labor negotiations fail to keep the mines open.
It's a requiem for the industry that built Britain, and with the closing of its last power station, coal will become a relic of the past.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston.
And from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.